The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome back to another episode of Burning Down the House on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. Now, those of you who live in the New York metropolitan area could not have escaped the news that our beloved gateway to the northern suburbs, yes, Grand Central Terminal, not to be confused with Grand Central Station, which is a subway stop, is 100 years old. 1913 seems, wow, incredibly a long time ago. 1913 was an incredible year. That was the year that we had the very famous armory show with Duchamp and all sorts of people, Robert Henri, and that actually was 100 years ago today, February 17th, the armory show. But today we want to talk about Grand Central. Our guests are Raju Mann, did I say that right?
It's beautiful.
Thank you very much. Who's the Director of Policy and Planning at the Metropolitan Art Society of New York City. Also with us is landscape architect Kathleen Bakewell. Good afternoon, Kate.
Hello.
Thanks for coming back. Grand Central is a wonderful space. To me, it is our last, until we replace them, agora of urban life in New York City. You know, sort of like a meeting place. Kate and I had some conversation about that a while back. And Kate said, oh, no, it's not an agora. It's so I had to have Kate come and talk with us. In no particular order, what I want to talk about with you, Raju, today is the role of the Municipal Arts Society in having saved Grand Central from destruction,
sure,
which was really key. I'd like to hear more about the Municipal Arts Society because I have to admit I'm a little bit ignorant about what you guys are doing.
Sure.
Look into the future. I would like to hear what your plans are for New York. And Kate, you're here to put your contributions in. We have no agenda. This is a conversation. The reason that we have this program is that we know that, or we intuitively know that the public is very interested in the kinds of conversations that go on among and between people involved in the design community. But to a great extent, they have no access to eavesdrop on the kinds of conversations that we have. So this is just a conversation. So in your role, Raju, at the MAS, on a day-to-day basis, what do you do?
Well, I think these days we're pretty occupied with the future of Grand Central and East Midtown in particular. Obviously, the 100th birthday happened, and MAS was a big part of the preservation of the building in the 60s and 70s, and we can talk more about that. But really, the day-to-day these days is focused on the future of Grand Central and East Midtown in particular. As you may have heard, the mayor has proposed a fairly ambitious redevelopment plan in the area around Grand Central, basically from about 40th Street to 57th Street,
yeah,
from about 5th Avenue to 3rd Avenue. And it's really, in some ways, his last, I think, legacy project of remaking Midtown, and I think in his image. And the proposal for us has raised a lot of concerns about where we're going as a city, what the future of our central business district looks like, how we are investing in our transit infrastructure and our preservation fabric, and how we kind of take places like Grand Central and renew the civic legacy of them. What does it mean to have a place like Grand Central? What are the lessons we need to take away from it? And how do we continue to sort of make sure it is a place where we go back to understand what's best about New York?
Right. Now, for those of you who are listening who have never been to New York, the Grand Central Terminal is a little bit east of the center of Manhattan Island, It's smack in the middle of the Midtown, what we call Midtown, business district, and it is also the a nexus of a great deal of rapid transit. We have two subway lines run through there. There's the shuttle to Times Square. There's the East Side IRT lines, the 4, 5, and 6 trains. Soon there will be a number 7 train stopping there.
That stops there today, actually. So the 7 is going to extend further to the west. It's going to,
yes, thank you.
Absolutely.
So 3 lines. Okay. And then there are commuter rails with the currently Metro North rail system.
That's right.
Which go up the Hudson, out into Westchester, and then east into all the way to New Haven, right, along the Connecticut shore. Mm-hmm. So there's a great deal of rapid transit, plus service by bus lines, and of course then there are taxis and private vehicles that all converge on this area. Well, let's talk about the Midtown East rezoning, and
sure,
we can get to the history later.
Okay,
but this proposal to upzone the area around Grand Central has a lot of resonance. If you look at the history of Grand Central, when in the 1960s, it was proposed to put a very large skyscraper right on top of that great hall. Kate, you describe the hall for us.
I think the hall is the closest thing we have to a cathedral that is secular. It's every time I came through it today, actually, on the way to this program, and every time you walk through that hall, your heart lifts. I'm sure that happens to people who are going through there every single day, and I'm there frequently, and it never fails to have that impact on me. And it's I could describe, I don't know how tall that ceiling is, but it's celestial. You know, it is a real sky.
And, well, the main hall is almost an entire Manhattan block long, and it has proportions of about, I don't know, 4 to 1 length to width, and then its height is probably two units of that width to height, and it has a barreled ceiling. And on the ceiling, there is a celestial chart describing the moment that, I guess it was Cornelius Vanderbilt, who was one of the owners of the New York Central Railroad, the moment of his birth, but seen from above looking down. So it's not really a celestial chart. It's just a really wonderful cerulean blue ceiling. And then what's really interesting to me is, for a public space, it has a lot of natural light, and
right,
and that just fills the space during the daytime with the possibility of shafts of light coming in, because the original design left a very high clear story level, even though at the second floor level there's a roadway that runs around the terminal so that Park Avenue traffic could divert and go around and then rejoin. These days, it rejoins and goes out through two tunnels at the Helmsley Building. At, what is that, 44th?
7th, I think.
All right. Further uptown.
Yeah.
And the space in between, then eventually, because of the efforts of the Municipal Art Society and also then the just then nascent Landmarks Commission compelled that development to have to move further up and sit over the train sheds,
right,
of the terminal.
Right.
Right. Now, today, these days, a lot of people are up in arms over the notion of redevelopment of the area around Grand Central because there are a lot of significant landmark buildings within that area. Seagram's, the Lever House, Chrysler Building, and a Gray Bar Building, which is adjacent to Grand Central, the former General Electric Building, which I think that's Landmark.
That's Landmark.
Yeah. But in their minds, they think that the almighty dollar might somehow have an influence and that these landmarks would be removed and replaced.
Right. I think there's a couple of issues there. So what the city's proposing to do basically is to significantly increase the density around Grand Central, and their argument is that that will incentivize the redevelopment of many buildings that are now beginning to show their age in a not helpful way for the city's economy. They're not the kinds of buildings that corporations are attracted to in the way that they were when they were built originally in the 50s and 60s, especially.
Exactly. Right.
So I think that the preservation issues are, I'd say, an important part of the conversation, because it's not necessarily about losing the Chrysler Building. The Chrysler Building will likely always be there. It's about losing buildings that perhaps are not landmark, but are landmark quality. So you mentioned the Gray Bar Building. The Gray Bar Building is not a landmark.
Right.
So there's the potential that those buildings might end up getting redeveloped. And then I think the second issue is that the relationship of these buildings with Grand Central, that the sort of composition that that area creates, with Grand Central acting kind of as a centerpiece, might become disrupted by the addition of buildings that are 12 or 1,300 feet tall, which is the kind of buildings that might get built in this proposal. So it's can we see the Chrysler Building from 42nd Street? Is that an important quality that New Yorkers share or tourists aspire to when they come to see New York? And so I think the preservation issues are not just about protecting buildings that might get torn down, but it's protecting a context of a neighborhood. Not that it's not always a place for growth and development, but there are certain key elements that perhaps make it uniquely that neighborhood that need to be preserved.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The notion, to me, that a replacement building might be 1,200 feet tall, practical terms, that means an 85-story building. That means that it would have to be more than just one building being replaced, because the proposal is to increase the floor area ratio, or FAR, to 21.6. If you take what that would mean in terms of gross volume or gross square feet, it would have to be a very large site. And I don't know that there are sites that have been assembled where that much rentable area could be removed. So to me, that seems perhaps a misplaced fear.
Can I respond to that?
Yes, please.
Yeah, so I think it's the challenge, I think, with all of these enterprises is not necessarily what the real estate market will do in 20 years, because I don't think anybody can predict that at the end of the day.
Right.
It's how do we plan to make sure that New York grows appropriately, that inspires, that we protect our past, we build great new public spaces, that we do all those sorts of things, and let the real estate market go where the real estate market goes. The issue is really making sure that we, as a public, define the civic virtues that we want to memorialize in a plan or zoning or in a preservation framework. And so I think the concern is not, from my perspective, is not really about can we predict whether lots will be assembled and therefore buildings be built. It's are we planning for the future in a thoughtful way? And I think that gets us into the conversations about, 100 years ago we built this amazing, amazing building. Why can't we continue to invest in transit infrastructure or great public spaces the way we used to?
Right.
And instead, our aspiration seems to be in just the height of buildings rather than the great civic virtues of places like Grand Central.
I cannot disagree with that. I have great misgivings about the planned tower next to MoMA, which will place a great burden on the infrastructure on an already very congested street and in a location that has no mass transit.
Right.
So, now, let's look at the role of the Municipal Arts Society. The zoning, or the upzoning proposal, has no, as I understand it presently, no component that talks about civic virtues or a give back, to the common weal of the city. To what extent do you think the Municipal Arts Society might be able to be a factor in driving civic virtue?
Right. I mean, I think that's really that's our mission statement in many ways. And so I think as part of this Midtown Grand Central Centennial discussions, we invited three different firms over the summer to do some sort of provocation. So SOM, Foster & Partners, and WXY. And we called this sort of design provocation the Next 100, obviously referring to the centennial, and asked them to sort of explore what are the kinds of public space, civic interventions this area could, that we could make here in order to sort of renew the legacy of places like Grand Central. And so there are some interesting ideas, a lot of really interesting ideas that came out of that conversation. We've been exploring this idea of how you perhaps restore the park and Park Avenue and make that more of an actual lush boulevard instead of just sort of this narrow green strip in the median. How you take places like Madison and Lexington, which are just in the 40s and 50s, pretty unfortunate places to walk through,
yes.
Especially during rush hour. How do you actually restore some level of a perhaps better relationship between people and the buildings and the traffic? Because right now, I think people are sort of the third priority in that discussion. Buildings perhaps first, traffic second, and pedestrians third. So how do you restore some balance there that makes sense? And how do you take places around Grand Central, Pershing Square is the sort of area around just to the south of Grand Central, and actually create perhaps new open spaces there, something the city's Department of Transportation is doing actually on 42nd Street. So we've been trying to drive the conversation around the public realm around Grand Central, how you make this area a much more pleasant, inviting, perhaps even inspiring place to walk. And so that's, one of our big I think points here. But we've also been looking at this larger conversation about the future of infrastructure in New York, and why we just seem, with a few exceptions, perhaps the extension of the 7 Line out to the West Side, with few exceptions, seem to really be able to invest in the next generation of infrastructure. And so we've been focused around that, around Penn Station as well, with the conversations about Madison Square Garden. But, our hope is that we can, and we've certainly had conversations with the city along those lines, continue to insist that what makes New York great is not the size of the buildings, it's the scale of the ambition when it comes to the public realm, and that includes infrastructure, that includes open space, and that when we get those things right, the market just responds because the area is such an inviting, desirable place to be.
What I think I'm hearing is the quality of life at the ground level is a focus.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I see that, I have it in my calendar here, that the Municipal Arts Society is having a public forum on the 26th of February.
That's right.
Tell us about that.
Sure. I mean, I think as part of our ongoing conversation with New Yorkers about what this proposal means, we've been having a series of forums to really try to unpack what might the future of Midtown look like, what might the future of New York look like as a result of this proposal, and what are the other directions perhaps we would see. So we've invited Peter Bishop, who was Mayor Livingston's director of the design. It's Design for London in London.
That's Boris Livingston of the UK.
That's right.
Yes,
right.
Okay.
So he's coming in from London to talk a little bit about the sort of London experience with these big challenges. And then we've invited a couple of faculty, Vicky Bean from NYU's Furman Center, who's a sort of real estate legal expert, Professor Segalian from Columbia University as well, who's written a pretty amazing book on Times Square Roulette. And again, the goal is to really explore what might the future of New York look like, and do we as a city want to have 1,400-foot-tall buildings or 1,300-foot-tall buildings scattered around Grand Central? And I think a lot of people do want that. But how do we insist on the kinds of public good that we think are essential to that conversation?
Can I jump in and ask about something that you touched upon only very briefly, and I would love to hear you expand upon, which is the visual skyline. So one of the things that's most spectacular about Midtown is when you come up out of the subway or you arrive, however, you see buildings like the Chrysler Building. So we're not talking about size anymore. We're talking about the beauty or the spectacular appearance of a building. There are a number of them in Midtown, and I know that's not something you can necessarily control ahead of time, but do you have conversations about that and how you can somehow ensure that inspirational quality in the skyline?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question because it's one of the issues that the city has put at the forefront of their discussion, which is that they, and this is a word that they were using, that they want to encourage the development of iconic skyscrapers. And that is a very obviously loaded design term.
Yeah, where did that come from? Is that coming from the City Planning Commission?
And actually, they in an earlier presentation this summer, they referenced iconic, and now they've switched to extraordinary as the terminology.
And so what is the thought of how we might go about, other than hiring starchitects, that's right. one way to go. Right. Well, is there a conversation about that going on?
Or abandon the Manhattanism of iconic skyscrapers and focus more on the quality of life on the street. I mean, if you're just flying over, that's exciting.
Right.
But Shanghai has more skyscrapers than Manhattan, than any place on the planet. And it's not a spectacular place just because it's got skyscrapers. That seems to me, if I may say, 19th century thinking. I would hope that that's a dialogue that, those of us who support the Municipal Arts Society can promote, that it's not about the skyline anymore.
Right. No, I think that's right. And I think that the challenge, I think that there's an allure and there's a certain, I think, ego that's associated with the skyline that's hard to avoid as a center of this conversation, and as important it is, I think there's a psychology with the skyline too that's very kind of wrapped up in our consciousness. I think as New Yorkers and certainly as probably as visitors to New York as well, but the buildings that I think ultimately contribute the most to the city are the ones that you experience on the street in a really kind of meaningful way. So it's the seamless connection to the below grade transit that some buildings have that actually make the experience of getting to work or going home quite mm-hmm. pleasurable. It's the retail activity on the street in certain places. If you compare, let's say, Lexington to Fifth Avenue, just a couple of avenues over, right. and the experience of the sort of limestone retail stretching along Fifth Avenue, I think, and that is a draw rather than the size of the buildings. And Rockefeller Center, too, I think that there's the buildings themselves aren't really necessarily what define that complex. It's really the connected network of open spaces and transit.
I totally agree. Jack, can we take like a minute and a half of musical break to regroup our thoughts? Burning Down the House on heritageradionetwork.org. Today we are talking about 100 years of Grand Central Terminal. But it's not just about having a transit hub that's a beautiful space, that's a gateway. It's about, really, the quality of public spaces in the city of New York. Joining us today are Kate Bakewell. She's the founder of BioCities, which is a foundation based on the idea that when people and nature work together in close and mutual alliances, communities prosper and endure. And also Raju Mann, who is a director of the Municipal Arts Society of the City of New York. And we've just been talking a little bit about the skyline. And then Raju brought up the topic of Rockefeller Center, which definitely has, 5, 6, 8 skyscrapers all around, centered on about 48th Street and just west of Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. But that aggregation of very tall buildings is very well served by transit, which is different from some of the areas in Midtown. And also, eventually, I want to talk about how possibly the area around Grand Central is already oversaturated with density of people coming and going. But let's talk about Rock Center.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's been a place that New Yorkers and really, I think, and architects really of all over the world have come to try to understand what high density looks like in a highly functional, pleasant, inviting, yes, desirable framework. And I think the critical lesson, I think, there in some ways is how much the open space defines the place and not the size of the buildings.
Absolutely.
And then I think you can actually in some ways ignore many of the buildings as you walk through the place. They just serve as frames for the public space. And I think that strategy has served New York incredibly well. If we think about the other great open spaces, how the buildings and the streets in some ways are just useful demarcations for the open space, but the open space is
really... Well, Kate, you're a landscape architect, and, mm-hmm, and the experience of Rock Center is all landscape.
Mm-hmm. And I'm also an ice skater. and one thing that's remarkable about that open space, among many, is that it's a sunken space, and typically sunken spaces do not work. They usually fail, and this is one of the rare exceptions.
Well, the ice rink is a sunken space, but
yes,
but the streets, you know, that run through Rock Center work pretty well.
Right, right. The whole complex is fantastic, I think, and you feel like, yes, the buildings are containing the space, but they're stepping aside politely, and yet you can go in those buildings, and when you go in there, that's another sensational experience also. what was that?
Yeah, what was that?
That was a rock. It was a rock. Rock Center.
But the space,
well,
is programmed.
Well, no, you're right
too,
in a way, because approaching the center of Rock Center from Fifth Avenue, you do descend somewhat towards that sort of intermediary level.
When you're going down the Channel Gardens, which are always
right,
so beautiful,
right,
and it's a processional, it's an experience, and it's actually one of the thoughts I had about thinking about Grand Central Terminal is this notion of procession and arrival that we have lost as designers. I think we are not really designing that into experiences. I cite two just off the top of my head: the Time Warner Center, when you go up to the Rose Room, it's you cram into an elevator, and that's just a degraded experience. And right now, the interim arrival at the Ground Zero Park is also atrocious. And I'm just thinking about Grand Central Terminal, how glorious that is. What happened? You know, why have we lost? Is it because we're so used to airports, we're so used to cars and garages that we don't care about this sense of arrival?
Or have
in a
we just
dignified manner?
Or have we just lost the ability to create it?
I just noticed that there seems to be a real absence of attention to that experience. Possibly the new Calatrava hub will be an exception to that, but it does seem to be lacking in a lot of civic design these days.
And I think one of the extraordinary things about that is it's not just the public sector that needs to insist on that approach. I mean, Grand Central was built by a private railroad company.
Right.
But they acknowledged or understood in a very intimate way all of the issues that Kate's describing. And so it's unfortunate in some ways that that has been lost. And it's not, I think, necessarily a civic virtue that needs to reside with the public sector in some form or with, you know, people who care about design. It needs to reside with the people who are building these places and building these buildings.
Well, if you're getting in, if we go back to 100 years ago, from what I've read, one of the aspects that was exalted was that Grand Central was built for electric trains, which was the wave of the future. And they got rid of the coal-burning... There are still some diesel trains that come in and out, but, you know, we don't want to talk about the Danbury line. But...
We definitely don't.
Once upon a time, I worked at Citibank, and I was an in-house architect, and we were building a branch, which is still there. It's mostly ATMs now, but there were times when you couldn't breathe the air because the diesel trains were parked underneath. One of the aspects of the redevelopment of, and you mentioned Park Avenue, making it more park-like, Park Avenue before all of this infrastructure, Park Avenue was 4th Avenue, and it was an open trench, and it was full of train tracks, and then it was decked over, I guess in the, what, the 1880s or something?
I think that when the development of the Terminal City, the New York Central Railroad had this sort of clever real estate idea, which is basically that you're going to build a terminal building, and then you're going to deck over 4th Avenue and create these new development parcels as a result of building that deck, and then they would sell the development rights on those parcels. And so you had the development in the 19-teens and the 1920s of the first kind of sequence of buildings along Park Avenue. So it's this first example of really a developer very cleverly flipping air rights, essentially, in order to generate a return to fund the infrastructure.
But I just a couple of days ago, I saw a photograph of Park Avenue in the 1920s, and the whole center of the avenue was a park.
Yeah,
and there were just a couple lanes on either side.
There's some, I think, very extraordinary images. Yeah, if you do a quick Google search of Park Avenue, you'll see this bucolic setting, I think, you know, almost 60 feet wide. So really meaningful open space there.
And curved lanes, as I recall, too. Is that correct?
Yeah.
But I can't imagine that the Municipal Art Society could possibly
move
public opinion back to that. I mean, if you think about the resistance to the bicycle lanes in New York, which restrict vehicular traffic, you know, in places like Park Slope, I mean, it's like tooth and nail war.
Yeah, I think that our approach is that we can't just resign ourselves to the status quo in terms of open space and public space and civic experience if it's not working. Not that Park Avenue isn't working, but there's opportunities to continue to kind of figure out these places and see how they're evolving and changing and make sure that as we bring more and more people to the heart of New York, that we're making the experience, that we're trying to find ways of ennobling the experience. And I think Park Avenue is an opportunity not necessarily to return to that 1920s bucolic setting, but to something slightly more gracious than what we have.
Right. So getting back to the Midtown East upzoning, I happen to have been the lead researcher on a study that was done by Terrapin Brett Green.
Okay.
Have you seen that one?
I have, yeah.
All right. I was the guy who was putting together all that stuff. And what we looked at was how you could make replacement building that included biophilic features. Now, for those of you who are not, in New York or in the profession, biophilia means incorporating. Well, Kate, you should speak to that. Your thing.
it's a term coined by E.O. Wilson, and it means a human's innate attraction or need to be with nature, essentially speaking. And then designers have taken that on to start to understand that nature has a role to play in every aspect of human life, and sometimes it's even just symbolic nature that can have an impact on how we feel about a space.
It could be more than symbolic. It could be actual planted areas that you could see.
But what I'm saying is the power of this is so strong that even a picture of nature can almost have effects that are measurable on human well-being.
Yeah.
So and the real thing, of course, is much, much better. But that's the idea.
Well, I'm interested in the real thing. So does the MAS have a biophilia committee or
no, we should.
I mean,
we should start one right now.
Well, okay.
I think that where this sort of overlaps with some of our thinking on the issue of the future of Midtown is what is the next generation of building mean? And if we're thinking very ambitiously about the size of the buildings, we should be thinking as ambitiously about the values those buildings represent. And I think certainly one of the things that's changed dramatically over the last 40 years is the public consciousness about these kinds of issues. So I don't know that we have a great answer to that question right now in terms of how we think about the environmental aspects of this next generation of buildings, but I think it's clear that those values need in some ways be reflected in that, in what pops up in this neighborhood. That if we have a 1,500-foot-tall building, and I keep getting higher with my building heights,
11, 12, 15.
Huh?
Right, exactly. That it represents something.
Suddenly it's a 150-story building that's 2,000 feet. But it's feasible.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's buildings. Vignoli's building a building that doesn't have any additional density like the density that's being proposed. That's 1,400 feet tall on 56th and Park. So
right, that's Raphael Vignoli, and he's an architect in New York, and that translates to, I don't know, 110 stories at about, I don't know, 12 or 14 feet per story. And but it's a dagger. I mean, it's a spike.
Right, right. So that allows him to get all the height, but the proposed rezoning, I mean, the Chrysler Building, and this is just for the sort of zoning FAR geeks out there, you know, the Chrysler Building is about 25 FAR. What the city's proposing to do in the area around Grand Central is up to 30 FAR. Bank of America is about 24 FAR.
Really?
The Bank of America Building on 42nd and 6th Avenue.
Yeah, where the Biltmore Hotel used to be.
No, I'm referring to your Bank of America building.
Oh, not mine. Oh, not mine. No. I was affiliated with them, but it's not mine. So that's a One Bryant Park,
right?
And it's a big glassy building that is adjacent north and west of Bryant Park. Yeah.
So I think that going back to the biophilia conversation, I think that how does a skyscraper begin to represent those kinds of values, I think are some of the questions we are raising. And
I would love that. I mean, I would love that the Municipal Arts Society could drive a dialogue about what are the alternatives to glass megalith structures. How about looking at things that have come before, like the Woolworth Building, the Chrysler Building, buildings that aren't just a glass shard?
Right.
Because New York hasn't been just about glass shards, but, you know, there seems to be this mania for another glass box.
And you know, it's
and where's the art in that?
It's interesting. One of the going back to this iconic skyscraper skyline discussion, one of the images that the city uses in their early presentations is Renzo Piano's Shard Building in London as an example of the kinds of buildings New York City needs to build.
Who brings that up?
It's actually in the Department of City Planning presentation around the rezoning. And so I think that there's this sense that somehow we have fallen behind on the aspirational skyscraper, even though we sort of created it, and that we need to find opportunities to build more. And I think that just to your point, I think that we're thinking about this very narrowly right now in terms of these new sleek, machine-like buildings. Of the future, and certainly those aren't necessarily New York's greatest buildings.
Well, if we go back to the example of One Bryant Park, the Bank of America New York headquarters, actually, really, it does very little for the street. I mean, there is an atrium, but because, like, and less so than the atrium that is behind the IBM building on Madison Avenue at 57th Street, or the promenade at the former AT&T building, which is just across the street. It's not the same as normal New York streetscape, because there aren't any little stores. There is not the permeability of facade. that encourages people to just interact with other people along that plane of the street line. What do you think might be possible in the future, you know, if we just put on our big hat of ideas of how could a tall building have, you know, a totally permeable, almost like a souk of many possible different little things, and make that understood that that should be part of the planning mix? I mean, how do we do that?
I think that...
I mean, do you agree that that is a quintessential New York experience?
Absolutely. I think that the publicness of even our most private buildings is a really essential feature of New York, unlike, I think, places like Shanghai, where the privateness of these buildings is, I think, far more reinforced. And so we've always been a street level retail kind of city that has people going in and out of many of these buildings and interacting with the buildings in various forms. And so I think that, I guess there's two or three critical pieces. I think one is the retail energy at the street level, mm-hmm. and making sure that it's really, it's not, you know, like a Bank of America, it's not a series of ATMs, but it's really retail that you can kind of interact with.
Right.
I think that's one essential piece. And I think the graciousness of that first story is really important then to make the retail viable and desirable as a place. I think it's the access to the transit below as well, given how much is happening below the streets in New York, especially in Midtown, that allowing for gracious passageways in and out of transit is quite critical. And then I think it's the way that the buildings really relate to the sidewalk. In some cases, they can set back or pull back from the street to create a more gracious sidewalk experience, which makes the building feel far less ominous or it doesn't dominate the street in a way that it could. And I'm thinking here of the Citicorp building, which is not necessarily the greatest example of an urban building, but the size of that building is in some ways masked by the open space around it. So you don't feel the power of the building when you're across the street from it the way you do perhaps from a distance.
Right. For its time, it was pretty good. But what you've just described in terms of a goal really approximates the Time Warner Center at Columbus Circle, because there is permeability at the street line. But it's rendered in such a cold and modernistic way that it is, once you penetrate the street wall, you could be in Dallas or Houston. It's not the scale of the retail environment is, well, it could be anywhere.
Well, I think that gets us back to Grand Central Terminal once again, because
yes.
I know one of their programming ideas, and Raju, you can probably speak to this in greater depth, is that all that retail is New York homegrown businesses. It's not the big homogenous stores that you see in every mall in America. And that's a problem with Time Warner. You walk into that and you don't, like you say, you think you're in Dallas.
It's
big glamorous mall,
yeah.
And who cares?
Right.
I mean
no,
it's really a shame.
It's very much like the Galleria in Houston.
Right. And so
but,
Grand Central Terminal,
right.
You walk in, you see these unique,
yeah.
New York businesses.
Well, there's a chocolate shop right there at Vanderbilt Place in 42nd Street, and it's, 300 square feet? And I'm sure they move a lot of chocolate. But it works. It works very well. And then next to it is a bigger store, but then next to it's a smaller store. And so there's a variation of things. So
I think one of the real challenges with this proposal is that by encouraging the development of increasingly larger Class A office buildings, those aren't the buildings necessarily that tend to embrace the energy of the neighborhoods around them. They tend to be buildings where heavily securitized, the lobbies are kind of deeply inaccessible usually,
right.
Often surrounded by a kind of pretty robust security perimeter,
right.
Of bollards, increasingly New York. And so those kinds of Class A office buildings are not ones that generally invite a real conversation with pedestrians and invite an interaction with pedestrians. And so I think one of the challenges of this proposal is how we can continue to insist on those interactions while still building very, very large commercial buildings.
Right. Now, if Penn Station were to move across the street to the old Farley building, it was built as a post office, and there's a flight of steps that goes up, I don't know, 20 or 30 steps. It sits on a plinth. That's not going to work in terms of having permeability for retail. But it's been there. I mean, you know, it's where we go to post our last-minute tax return, you know, while the tax protests are going on outside. And whatever would happen to the former site, I mean, that's the story.
Right.
Does the Municipal Arts Society have thoughts about what should happen there?
So this is, I think, an interesting New York story. I think many New Yorkers know it well. But in 1963, the City Planning Commission and the Board of Estimate at that time recommended the demolition of the old Penn Station, which was designed by McKim, Mead & White, the same architects who designed the post office across the street.
Right.
And that really, kind of connecting back to our Grand Central discussion, that really lit a fire underneath the preservation movement, and the preservation, I think that created the Landmarks Preservation Commission in many ways, and created the first landmarks law. So 50 years later, so 1963 was 50 years ago, 50 years later, we're looking back and I think seeing the full measure of our mistake. And one of the ideas that's been discussed over the last really couple of decades is this idea of moving Madison Square Garden across the street. And the big challenge with the garden and Penn Station today is that it sits on top of Penn Station. So it's very difficult to make the kinds of improvements you'd need to make in order to make Penn Station a functional place. So the plans have been to move the garden across the street into the old post office building and really rebuild Penn Station on the site of the old Penn Station. And you know, if you go back and look through the history, there's been, you know, Frank Gehry's put together ideas. Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill have put together ideas for what that station looks like.
Yeah.
Foster and Partners. There's been a whole series of design proposals for that site. The challenge has always been the political and financial will to make it happen. And that's something that we're quite focused on this year, because one of the quirks of this discussion right now is that our Madison Square Garden needs to renew their right to operate an arena there. And this is something that requires public review and requires city council vote. And one of the things that we're arguing for is that the garden shouldn't be allowed to continue to use that site forever, that we should create a planning period, a 10-year period, and move the garden off the site and then figure out how to rebuild Penn Station.
But wouldn't that just result in the garden desecrating the former post office the way that it did the previous Penn Station?
That's something that some preservationists are quite concerned about, absolutely, sort of the beer signs on top of, you know, the Farley Post Office or the Knicks billboards. It is a designated New York City landmark, so there are protections to go along with that. And I think the sensitivities around the garden and the post office building, I think, will hopefully create a slightly more vigilant environment than existed 50 years ago.
Well, let's go back to the example of what was saved at Grand Central. What makes it great?
I think that at the end of the day, I think it's this it's a place that makes people feel ennobled when they walk through it. And there's many, I think, specific design decisions that created that experience. But I think it's an ennobling experience. I think it's a place that makes you feel psychologically lifted. And I think that's why people keep coming to it and are so attached to it as a place. It actually makes them feel better when they walk through it. And I think that's what all... At the end of the day, this is not really about the size of buildings or the form of buildings. It's about the experience that we have as humans in our city. And I think Grand Central creates an experience that's unlike any other in New York and really probably in the world.
Sure. Yeah. But in part, it's because it's a transit hub, right? So there are always people coming and going, so they have a reason to have to go there.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, I think it's a transit hub, but I don't think it's, I think fundamentally a public space that happens to be a transit hub. I mean, obviously the transit hub is the critical functional use of the building, and it's why it exists. But I think I always experience it more as a space that I walk through to get to a train.
No, I was going to jump in about this ennobling experience. It just occurred to me, coming here today, I saw a wedding party and they were having their photos taken. Now, how many transit hubs in the world would have a wedding party where that's where they go, the destination to have the, you know, to celebrate their wedding? It was a beautiful sight. I didn't take a picture, but it was. I mean, that's the kind of thing you see, that kind of thing all the time there.
Well, it's a grand place. Were they on the steps?
They were actually on that ramp that goes down to the Oyster Bar.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So, and it was, they were, of course, all laughing, and it was just a beautiful little scene. But the other thing, in addition to how the space and the materials and the light and just the beautiful details, it also was engineered so well. And it just pragmatically speaking, it just works very well in terms of the movement of people. And, of course, those are all the nuanced moves that you make that seem effortless but are really thought out very carefully.
That's great. I'm happy for them. Good luck. I always feel that that at weddings they should play the way we were. But that's, you know, because I'm a medievalist and, you know, we always have to have a memento mori. But what we're talking about is transit-oriented design to a certain extent. And there are not that many opportunities, in Manhattan at least, for transit-oriented design. I mean, okay, there's a redevelopment of the Fulton Street hub, and God knows how that's going to turn out.
Right.
I mean, that's been 20 years, and who knows what's really going to happen there. But I guess the question that comes to me is, what lessons can we learn from transit-oriented hubs or design to redevelopment? Because redevelopment of the area of interest here, the Midtown East, I mean, it's probably going to happen, right? So what ideas can be gleaned from the vibrancy of the environment of Grand Central? What can be taken out into the streets? What advocacy positions can the Municipal Arts Society take to city planning to say, this and this and this should be a piece of, under what circumstances that you actually permit these upzoning projects to exist?
Right. It's a great question. I think there's a few, I think, core principles that underpin our approach here. I think the first one is that the area really only exists because of its infrastructure. Infrastructure has been a driver of development and a driver of the vitality of the neighborhood. And so as we move forward, we need to make sure the infrastructure continues to be in place and we continue to expand on it. So, for example, the 456 train, which is the East Side subway, is at about 116% capacity today. Mm. And so if we continue to allow for development to occur without really addressing the infrastructure issues, we're going to put ourselves in a very difficult situation. So we need to invest in infrastructure first. So that means improvements to the 456, to the 7 train, which runs from Queens into Hudson Yards, which will increasingly become more important. It means thinking more creatively about bus rapid transit. There've been ideas for 42nd Street for many years as a light rail street, essentially getting light rail east west on it. Improved ferry service to 42nd Street on the east side. So there's all these ideas that have been out there that we need to kind of return to make sure that infrastructure again is the driver of the development decisions.
Well, could the conversation about infrastructure somehow be extended to fostering smaller businesses in the streetscape?
Yeah, and I think that, so then, you know, I think another principle that's really underpinning our work is that the best New York neighborhoods are ones that are diverse and complex, yeah. And those are the reasons people come to New York and stay in New York and build a business in New York. And so that street life, that energy, which may not actually, isn't all that great in parts of Midtown, we need to find ways of injecting it. So I think it's smaller retail, it's the kind of retail permeability we've been talking about, and it's a mix of uses. The city's proposal doesn't allow any residential development to occur with the new density that's added. We think that...
Yeah, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that the sense is that that's a... I mean, you know, my perspective anyways, it's a very 1960s way of looking at a central business district.
Yeah.
As a place where you just come to go to work and then you leave. The cities have gotten much more complicated, and that's good for them.
Oh, and building technology has got more complicated because, for example, going back to not my One Bryant Park... I was affiliated with those people. But it has a cogeneration system. And that's gas-powered turbines that create heat and also energy. And the energy that's excess when it's running, when you're not using it in the office building, could be used to make ice storage. But that excess heat doesn't do much for you in an office building. But... if that were a mixed-use building, that excess heat would be making domestic hot water. So cogen systems work really well, at least in a mixed-use development. And by the way, around Grand Central, it would make a lot of sense for people to live there because then they could get down into the transit hub and go to their jobs elsewhere. Or walk to work.
Sure. And I think that the beauty of residential development, too, is that it encourages other kinds of uses to pop up. So you have different kinds of retail, different kinds of restaurants, which, in fact, actually support the commercial office users as well. So you have this more interesting and lively mix that I think characterizes many New York neighborhoods.
I'd like to just, as we imagine that whole area becoming more and more dense, and also the Long Island Railroad, too, is another one.
Yes.
It's starting to become quite unbearable for New Yorkers to move around in Midtown during certain parts of the year. And for the livability of us who live here year-round, I think we need to really think through the sidewalks a little bit differently. We love having the tourists. That's great. But it can start to really get at you, be very irritating to try to move around, just get to your destination when you're just blocked all the time. Fifth Avenue is atrocious during this winter season.
And that is a very good argument against upzoning this area.
Well, I would rather see the sidewalks handled differently. Maybe it's take over another lane, that fewer car lanes, fewer parking
lanes.
It's been done
on Broadway. Right.
And Broadway, like in Times Square, at least that is better. That is better. We have more pedestrian space. There's more ability to move around, to dart and dash around the people who are standing there and gawking. And everyone is accommodated much better, at least people on foot.
Well, Raju, to what extent do you think that the Municipal Arts Society has any clout with city planning?
It's an interesting question. I think that really we see our audience not necessarily as the Department of City Planning or the mayor's office on this. I think we see our audience really as New Yorkers who care about these issues. And if we can get them motivated to engage on understanding the infrastructure and the public space and the preservation issues that are at stake here, we think that we'll have gone a long way in influencing the discussion that happens in the city. So, these are contentious conversations with very strong personalities. And so it's always hard to know exactly how much influence you have as an organization. But I think given our history here and certainly helping to save Grand Central, there's, we think, a little bit of a moral, maybe I'm overreaching here, but a little bit of a responsibility that we have as an organization to protect.
But maybe not morally overreaching, because the foundation of the Municipal Arts Society was artistic and part of the City Beautiful movement, of the 1890s, where there were civic-minded people who wanted to make the beauty of the city enhanced.
Right, right.
And there were some results of that. I mean, the furtherance of those gateways to Central Park, you know, like the monument that's opposite Time Warner, the main monument right. there.
Columbus Circle.
Yeah, Columbus Circle was a result of that.
Yeah, as an organization, we started out, as you were describing, kind of committed to enlivening the city with public art and raising kind of the design standards for the city. And again, you know, going back to this idea that it's really not about the size of buildings, it's about the public experience that matters and that defines cities. And so I think that we have, over the years, reoriented in some ways where we focus. It's probably a little bit less on kind of the public art piece, but that still continues to be an animating principle that we have to find ways of beautifying and enlivening the city, and that ultimately is an economic development rationale. It will produce the kinds of economic returns, the sort of more sober financial types want to see, but it does it by enhancing the civic experience.
Amen to that. Kate Bakewell, I'll give you last words.
That's a lot of pressure, Curtis.
Come on. I know you've got a lot to say. What would you like to see happen as a result of this examination of increasing the density? What should go along with that?
Just a lot of attention paid to the street experience that Raju has already been alluding to quite a bit. And just the fact that we are going to be becoming more and more populated with people living here, people visiting here, and it really is a reality that we have to that is important for us to face and think about redesigning streets so that the livability of the city continues to get better and better.
Exactly, because the city itself has identified in Plan YC that by 2013, in 17 years, we expect that there'll be 1 million more people in the five boroughs. That's a lot of people, and a great many of them will have to come in and out or live in Manhattan in this district that we're talking about. And without an independent, vocal, not oversight, but almost like the consciousness of the common good agency. Well, you're an NGO. I mean,
right.
It could be a very bad experience.
And I think that there's lots of forces at play in large cities like New York, financial or otherwise, that don't necessarily prioritize the kinds of issues that I think we're talking about today. And so the challenge always is, how do we get people engaged in these conversations, as you're doing? And how do we make sure that we live up to the legacies of places like Grand Central? Because we've inherited these things
Yes.
that are incredibly defining places, and we have a responsibility, to then make sure as the next generation to continue to remind ourselves of why these places are incredible and what we can do to make them
or
better.
Or perhaps create another one.
Absolutely.
Or several. Because we need places like Grand Central that are like our agoras, where you can say, well, I'll meet you by the information kiosk. And then, of course, then you get on the cell phone. What side of the kiosk are you on? And you can circle around forever. Because there's no more, really, I mean, there is the Biltmore Room, but the Biltmore Room isn't the Biltmore Room
right.
anymore. Because it's just a shoeshine place. This is really been a great conversation. We've been talking with Raju Mann from the Municipal Art Society and Kathleen Bakewell of biocities.org. Tell us again, Raju, about the upcoming event.
Sure. So we've got a great discussion on February 26th at the CUNY Grad Center, which is on 34th and 5th Avenue. It's at 4 p.m. If you're interested in the future of Midtown or the future of cities, really encourage you to attend that. I think it should be a great program.
It's unfortunate that it's at 4, because some of us have jobs.
I know.
But it's kind of, but we it's a good reason to say, hey, I've got to go. I want to know what's going on, right?
Absolutely. It'll be a good intellectual break. You can return refreshed to work.
Excellent. This has been Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.